Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast. This week we're in Hay on Wye, where for the last 30 years an annual miracle has taken place. The transformation of a sleepy country town on the Welsh borders into the centre of world literature. It's hard to believe, but for 50 weeks of the year, the spot I'm now standing in is a field, where the only tweeting you're likely to hear is of blackbirds and crows. Just listen to it now.
It's a city under canvas with restaurants, a huge bookshop and 15 venues, ranging from a cosy storytelling nook to the huge Tata Stadium, which holds 1,700 people. It's about ideas and arguments and prize pigs and stinky socks.
Is Christina Stevenson introducing the latest in her picture book series, Sir Charlie's Stinky Socks. Sian's been doing the rounds of the festival, and it's your first time here, Sian. Is it what you expected?
Not at all, really. It's much busier than I was expecting to be. It's much bigger than I was expecting it to be. And it's quite marvellous to be in a place where, like, where I'm standing right now, I can see a whole field full of sheep over there, and then I've got all these people around here, and just a moment ago I was sitting right next to Stephen Fry, and it's just quite a bizarre little world full of just amazing talkers and amazing ideas, and it's really quite buzzy.
So what have you particularly liked?
Well, speaking of Stephen Fry, he was particularly good. Just last evening, he delivered his Reformation for the Internet, which was an hour-long talk that he gave, and that was very, very good. I've also enjoyed seeing people that I wouldn't normally seek if I was sort of just coming here as a visitor, and people like Paula Hawkins, who was quite good yesterday as well, and also Jeremy Paxman, which was entertaining to say the least.
One of the highlights for me was seeing Helen Fielding winning the Bollinger Everyman Woodhouse Prize for comic fiction. Part obviously from lashings of pink champagne, which our producer Susanna was particularly interested in. The prize entitles the winning novel to have a pig named after it in honour of P.G. Woodhouse's Empress of Blandings, of course. So there will henceforward be a Welsh porker named Bridget Jones's baby. And here's Helen Fielding revealing one of the enduring secrets of Bridget Jones to comedian Viv Groskop.
It's interesting you say you would worry that your own children would read it and think it was you. With all the time that has passed since you first saw Bridget in your mind's eye and started writing her diary, Can you say now that it was based a little bit on you?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I was just embarrassed because I was trying to write serious novels. I'd written one novel about celebrities and famine called Celeb. I was writing another novel about cultural divides in the Caribbean and tourism and the local people. It was so boring. And the newspaper asked me to write a column as myself, sort of life in London. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, that's just so embarrassing and exposing, but I'll make this character up. I'd already tried her out in a sitcom for the BBC, which didn't get made, called 30's Panic. But then when people realised it was me, I was just like, oh, God, it's great, but it's also, she's a very exaggerated character. She drinks 12 alcohol units a day and she's shagging and saying all these things I'd never have dared say if I'd known so many people would read it. So that I was very sort of shy about the connection.
But now let's get serious. Over the years, the festival has hosted a dazzling array of international movers and shakers, from South Africa's Desmond Tutu to America's Bill Clinton, who putted golf balls into the River Wye and obligingly dubbed the festival the Woodstock of the Mind. Among this year's political big hitters is the Indian MP and diplomat Shashi Tharoor, who has no time for such craven flattery. His latest book is called Inglorious Empire, What the British Did to India. What it did was bad, as he told our own Randeep Ramesh.
It's really a takedown, I suppose, of imperialism. And it might seem familiar, I'm sure, at home, but to British eyes in the beginning of the 21st century, it's a pretty poor view of what we did or didn't do in India.
Right, well, I think it's probably a bit overdue here. And even in India, somewhat to my surprise, it seems to have catalysed an awareness of things that people were sort of loosely conscious of but hadn't really achieved some clarity about. And so I think my book has struck a chord in ways that frankly, more than I could have expected. I think it sold something like 50,000 copies in hardback in India, which is quite exceptional for a hardback, almost in living memory. The other thing about the book in Britain is that it comes at a time when, for the last decade or so, there have been a number of revisionist histories trying to portray the empire as a jolly good thing. Neil Ferguson's phrase with a capital J, capital G, and capital T. And arguing, as Lawrence James did, that it was an exercise in benign altruism, the like of which the world hasn't seen. And Ferguson's suggestion that it laid the foundations for today's globalization and therefore the victims of it ought to be grateful. And that sort of stuff. Coupled with these extraordinary YouGov polls we've seen for the last few years, in which alarmingly high percentages of English people seem to be proud of the empire and wish they had it back. So I think it was time in this country to confront people with the reality of the empire as experienced by the places in which the empire flourished, and therefore knock the convenient historical amnesia that is an enabler for these fantasy views of the British Empire.
Okay, I mean, that's obviously you being blunt and forthright, as you should be.
As I usually am.
As you usually are. Can I just suggest that imposing a view, imposing liberty on a subject people brought you Macaulay as well as the Bengal famine. So would you not, you and I are divided by a common language, English. You might not have had it without the experience of British rule. What say you to the soft power that you inherited? I can understand the hard power
disadvantages. I don't think one gains much soft power from the hard end of a British policeman's truncheon, but or the stout British boot, as to quote the title of an ode composed by Punch magazine in the 19th century for a favoured instrument of British discipline of Indians, the stout British boot. No, I think one really has to see the fact that Macaulay is seen as this enlightened liberal. In India, he's seen as the man who fatuously sneered that the entire learning of all the libraries of India and America were not worth, India and Arabia were not worth those of a single shelf of English books, for example, and that sort of absolute codswallop, because Macaulay was very much a racist prisoner of the limitations of his own education, coupled with the great certitude that they had found the answers that the Enlightenment provided the blessed Englishman. I'm sorry to say that Macaulay is not thought of very well in India. I mean, certainly thought of more kindly than the Bengal famine, but
I accept that. In your book, you sort of make the case for atonement, which is quite an interesting concept, because you sort of say, look, I think there are about 6 million Indians over the age of 80 who'd have had direct experience of imperialism.
And their children have heard about
And you say you expand that to about 100 million people, I think. And you said the impact of essentially saying sorry in a meaningful way, almost as performance art, but to sort of convey a very strong message that Britain had something to make up for, would change, I think, the atmospherics that you think pervade our relationship today.
Yes, I think it would be very healthy. Let me explain. I mean, obviously atonement is an alternative to the call for reparations, which I personally don't subscribe to. Even in the Oxford Union debate, which first brought this issue to prominence, which was about reparations, I said I'd be content with a symbolic £1 a year, simply because I don't think you can put a real value, monetary value, on the human lives lost, the damage done, the 35 million who perish in unnecessary famines, and so on and so forth. Having said all of that, I did say that atonement was still necessary, and it can take two forms. One is simply teaching history, colonial history, in your schools. Today, it is possible to go to the best schools in England, the best public schools in England, take the A-levels in history and not learn a line of colonial history. I think that's a disgrace. But the second thing, I think, is an apology. And I have the perfect time coming up for it, which would be the centenary of the Jallianwala Bagh massacre, the Amritsar massacre, as some know it in this country, which in many ways, though in numbers it was far from being the worst atrocity of the British Raj, in everything that surrounded it, I think, epitomizes the worst of the British Empire in India. It followed a betrayal when the British essentially elicited Indian support for the First World War by promising responsible self-government after. The likes of Mahatma Gandhi supported the British war effort, expecting that Dominion status would follow. India sent 1.3 million men to fight for the British, including, by the way, stopping the German advance at Ypres in August 1914, failing which the First World War might not have lasted quite as long. And having done all of that, supplied not just men, but also large quantities of money, treasure, vehicles, carts, carriages, pack animals, food, uniforms, clothing, and even rail lines ripped out of the ground and sent off to aid the war effort. A sum total valued in today's money at about £80 billion. And after that colossal contribution from an impoverished nation, the British broke their promises, and they ended up essentially reimposing wartime era restrictions on the Indian people. So the first thing was this betrayal. The second was when protests rose against these restrictions on freedom of press, freedom of assembly, freedom of opinion, all of these things. When protests rose, the British essentially declared martial law in many places, Punjab in particular. And in the city of Amritsar, they sent General Dyer to impose their fiat. Dyer heard about a gathering in a walled garden in Amritsar. It happened to be Baisakhi, the big spring festival, and peasants from the villages surrounding the city had happened to have come to celebrate Baisakhi. They may have also wanted to listen to some anti-British speeches, more power to them, but they were completely unarmed and defenseless. They weren't there to do anybody any harm. Dyer marched in with his soldiers, did not issue any warnings, didn't ask them why they were there, didn't fire any warning shots. Just ordered his soldiers to clinically, coldly open fire on the unarmed, defenseless men, women and children. Large numbers of women and children were killed. He stationed them at the only exit from the garden, the gate, so that as they fled, wailing to what they presumed was safety, they were mown down. He himself testified very proudly that made them easier targets. Mm. Practically no bullet was wasted. Every bullet fired either took a life or maimed a human being. At the end of this brutality followed the racism. He shut the gates and wouldn't let anyone tend to the dead, dying or wounded for 24 hours. They rotted in the hot April sun, the dying crying out piteously for water that their relatives outside the gate couldn't give them. Indians were forced to crawl on their bellies on a street in Amritsar, and if they so much as raised their heads while crawling, the heads were bashed in by British staves. At the end of all of this, of course, there was a public outcry. A commission of inquiry sought to whitewash his crime. The House of Commons, however, censured him. The House of Lords exonerated him and praised his actions. And then the British raised a collection to honour and reward him for the massacre, the equivalent in today's money of £250,000, presented to him with a bejeweled sword, with that flatulent voice of Victorian imperialism, Rudyard Kipling, hailing him as the man who saved India. So it was the entire thing, the betrayal, the brutality, the racism, the self-justification and the reward, that entire package that makes the Jallianwala Bagh almost the perfect epitome of everything that was wrong about the empire. Imagine if a member of the royal family, because everything was done in the name of the crown, came to Amritsar on the 13th of April 2019, went down as Willy Brandt had done in the Polish ghetto on bended knee and expressed remorse, contrition, for this massacre and by extension for all the wrongs of the empire. What a magnificently cleansing act that would be. What a signal it would send to Indians, and what an educative effect it would have on the English, who've chosen to forget what the empire was all about.
And I think therein lies your problem. It's one of perception. Your view of history isn't what the Brits view their history as. The Willy Brandt comparison, I mean, in our view, of course, Willy Brandt had everything to plead for forgiveness, to supplicate, to genuflect. I mean, that was what we understand as right. What's difficult is when you don't believe or understand or take your version of events, you think you have nothing to apologise for.
Well, the facts that I've just summarised for you about the massacre are not contested. The only contestation is about the numbers. The British say that Dyer killed 379 and injured 1,000-odd. The Indians say he killed 1,000-odd and injured another 1,000-odd. Mm. So that's, apart from that, every other detail I've given you is verified by multiple sources and is not challenged. Mm. So if you don't think that's something worth apologising for, then, to be honest, I mean, honestly, there's nothing more to be said, is there? I mean, if somebody does all of that and says we have nothing to apologise for, what would you say to them? Last year, the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, apologised in the Canadian Parliament to the people of India for an indirect sin far smaller than this, when he apologised for the Komagata Maru incident. The Komagata Maru was a Japanese ship bearing Indian refugees were turned away at gunpoint from the port of Vancouver, and almost everybody on board came to a grisly end, either on the high seas or at British hands after the ship came back to port. Now, in those circumstances, when Canada was only indirectly responsible for these debts, Trudeau felt it fitting a century later to apologize to the people of India from the British Parliament. Now, I don't expect a British politician to do that from the British Parliament here. The Canadian Parliament perhaps is a different sort of place. But surely the Crown must have a conscience.
But aren't we like many other Europeans in that respect? I mean, the French do not mention the Algerian hinterland in their own history. The Belgians don't go to the Congo and on bended knee and renounce themselves.
They should.
So are we Brits not very European in our amnesia?
Look, I'm not going to fight everybody's battles for them. They'll have to find their own advocates. For me, I think the Belgians should apologize. I think probably the French should apologize. I know less about I've read too much, I suppose, of the French side of the story, as well as, of course, the accounts of Fanon and others. But the truth is that when you look back at that period, there were atrocities committed by a lot of people, and apologies could well be in order from all of them. My country happened to suffer under the British boot, and so it's the British boot that I want off my historical memory.
Can I also tuck you on another aspect of your book? And I know you don't like counterfactuals, but one of the things that you bring up, which is Angus Maddison's kind of economic data, and it's quite right to say that India was a very large economic weight in the world.
27% of global GDP in 1700.
Partly due to its population, I think you'll concede.
But also due to its prosperity, because the revenues of King Aurangzeb in 1700 exceeded those of all the crowned heads of Europe put together, sure, including the king in Buckingham Palace and Louis in Versailles.
But what isn't contested in world history, I think, is that Britain was the place in which the Industrial Revolution took place first. It was a magical event in some ways. People dispute why it came about. Was it Protestantism? Was it coal? Where it didn't occur was India.
Why not? Because if India missed the bus for the Industrial Revolution, it's because Britain threw us under its wheels.
Or that you weren't going to be the place where it happened. That's the counterfactual.
If it hadn't been for the British, I think we would have been, because Indians showed an amazing willingness to adapt to technology and to purchase what they couldn't make themselves. I mean, they were very rich. I mean, we were, for example, the leading textile manufacturers in the world. If industrial making of textiles had come along, do you think some extremely prosperous, profit-making textile merchant wouldn't have imported a textile mill to India? Of course he would have. It's just that the textile industry was stamped into the ground, looms were smashed, tariffs and duties imposed by the British on the export of the fine Indian cloth, which at one time was so prized here in Europe that British shopkeepers used to try and pass off shoddy European-made cloth as made in India because the quality of Indian cloth was such a byword. So with that kind of record, do you think a wealthy Indian textile exporter wouldn't have imported a machine when those machines were invented? I'll give you a striking example in a different field, shipbuilding. India made some of the finest ships in the world in the wooden ship era because of their very high quality woodwork and brasswork and the durability of Indian wood, mahogany and teak, by comparison with the fir and pine in Europe that barely lasted 6 or 7 years each ship. So when the steamship was invented and people were cobbling together steel plates and so on to make steamships, an enterprising shipbuilder in Bengal made a steamship. So they actually had to be actively prevented by the British from taking advantage of modern technology. And that's exactly what happened.
But I could name, you know, the steam engine, the stock exchange advances.
I mean, Britain wasn't the only place in the world. It may have been the first, but wasn't the only place in the world where there was an industrial revolution.
No, France.
The Germans, the Americans, the French, everybody could buy British technology. I mean, just as today the Chinese are prospering from buying German machines, why couldn't the Indians have prospered in the 19th century buying British machines as a free country?
Let's go on to the sociological, because you would have read Karl Marx and his view of imperialism in terms of bringing India out from the darkness that he
claimed. Oh, he was as racist as the rest of them, all this twaddle about Oriental despotism.
Yes.
I don't really take Marx very seriously on India, not much on anything else, but certainly Oriental despotism was a particularly ignorant and ill-informed piece of analysis. He'd never really been to India. I mean, obviously, he was sitting, as you know, in the British Library and churning out all this deathless prose. So, I mean, I can't take all that terribly seriously. The fact is that there are intelligent critiques of all that was wrong in India before the British came, and I'm by no means pretending it was by anything like a perfect place. But at least whatever went wrong was going wrong at Indian hands. We were responsible for our own mistakes. They weren't thrust upon us to serve the interests of a people from a faraway country who were draining our resources and sending it there. You know, there are people who argue that the Mughals looted as well. Hmm. Sure enough, whatever they looted, they spent in India.
Why do you think because your narrative, I think, is actually quite well embedded in a lot of Indian psyche. I understand that there has been revisionism even in India, and that partly may have been with the failure of the Nehruvian project politically. But, you know, after independence, many of India's leaders were actually quite affectionate to Britain. I'll give you an example. When the Nizam of Hyderabad wasn't going to join the Indian Union, he was supported, at least by words, by William Churchill in the House of Commons. Yet the Indian leaders of the time kind of just went about with what they were doing, which is effectively to send tanks in and, you know, put down a rebellion, an insurgency as they saw it. But they didn't take it out on the British thereafter. Why not? If this persuasive argument exists and everyone understands it in India, why did the post-independence leadership of India take such a benign view of history?
A couple of reasons. There's an anecdote I repeat in the book that may well be an apocryphal one, of Nehru meeting that self-same Churchill and being asked, you know, after we put you in jail for 10 years of your life, how is it you bear so little rancor towards us? And Nehru says, well, I was taught by a great man, Mahatma Gandhi, never to fear and never to hate, which in some ways was very much the attitude. You know, Gandhi had this very Hindu view that you must hate the sin but not the sinner. And the moment the sin of the British Empire in India, a word, by the way, he used in a letter to a viceroy, he called it a sin. But when the sin came down with the Union Jack on the midnight of August 15th, 1947, there no longer was a sinner. So why hate? And I think this forgive and forget attitude is deeply embedded in the Indian national character. I've been saying through this book and around this book that, yes, you must forgive because hatred is a negative emotion, but you must not forget. If you don't know where you've come from, how on earth will you know appreciate where you're going?
Shashi Tharoor there talking to Randeep Ramesh. But for all the glorious controversies of the festival, let us not forget that fiction too can be challenging and political. Cory Doctorow's latest novel, Walkaway, imagines a world plunged into climate disaster. Automation has made the overwhelming majority economically redundant, with all but a handful of the pampered ultra-rich living in grinding poverty. Faced with a life of endless debt and precarious employment, some people have started to walk away from mainstream society and use technology to build another way to live. When we nabbed him en route to the festival, Doctorow transported us to a tavern called the Belt and Braces, where three new walkaways are struggling to understand how this alternative lifestyle could possibly work.
Hey there, how are you enjoying your noob's day here at the glorious Belt and Braces? He ducked. I feel like I'm going to explode. I've been fed, drugged, boozed, and had a nap by the fire. I just can't sit there anymore. Put me to work, please. You know that's something you're not supposed to ask. I got that impression. There's something weird about you. I mean, us and work. You're not supposed to covet a job, and you're not supposed to look down your nose at slackers, and you're not supposed to lionize someone who's slaving. It's supposed to be emergent, natural homeostasis, right? I thought you might be clever. That's it. Asking someone if you can pitch in is telling them that they're in charge and deferring to their authority. Both are verboten. If you want to work, do something. If it's not helpful, maybe I'll undo it later or talk it over with you or let it slide. It's passive-aggressive, but that's walkaways. It's not like there's any hurry. He chewed on that. Is there? Is there really abundance? If the whole world went walk away tomorrow, would there be enough? By definition, she said. Because enough is whatever you make it. Maybe you want to have 30 kids. Enough for you is more than enough for me. Maybe you want to get your calories in a very specific way. Maybe you want to live in a very specific place where a lot of other people want to live. Depending on how you look at it, there'll never be enough, or there'll always be plenty. While they gabbed, three other walkaways prepped tea, hand-finished scones and dainty sandwiches and steaming pots and adulterants arranged on the trays. She consciously damped the anxiety at someone doing her job. So long as the job got done, that's what mattered. If anything mattered. Which it did. But not in the grand scheme of things. She recognized one of her loops. Well, that settles that, she said, jerking her chin at the people bringing out the trays. Let's eat. I don't think I can. He patted his stomach. You guys should install a vomitorium. They're just a legend, she said. Vomitorium just means a narrow bottleneck between two chambers, from which a crowd is vomited forth. Nothing to do with gorging yourself into collective bulimia. But still, he looked thoughtful. I could install one, couldn't I? Log into your back end, sketch it out, and start looking for material, taking stuff apart and knocking out bricks? Technically, but I don't think you'd get help with it, and there'd be reverts when you weren't around, people bricking back the space you'd unbricked. I mean, a vomitorium is not only apocryphal, it's grody. Not the kind of thing that happens in practice. But if I had a gang of trolls, we could do it, right? Could put armed guards on the spot, charge admission, switch to Big Macs? This was a tedious noob discussion. Yeah, you could. If you made it stick, we'd build another belt and braces down the road, and you'd have a building full of trolls. You're not the first person to have this little thought experiment. I'm sure I'm not, he said. I'm sorry if it's boring. I know the theory, but it just doesn't seem like it could work. It doesn't work at all in theory. In theory, we're selfish assholes who want more than our neighbors, can't be happy with a lot if someone else has a lot more. In theory, someone will walk into this place when no one's around and take anything. In theory, someone will walk into this place when no one's around and take everything. In theory, it's bullshit. This stuff only works in practice. In theory, it's a mess.
Doctorow calls Walkaway an optimistic disaster novel. So Richard Lee started by asking him, in the aftermath of terrorist incidents such as the recent Manchester attack, how can a disaster story possibly be optimistic?
Well, it's not optimistic to build a system with the expectation that it will never fail. People who build systems with the expectations that they'll just be eternal and never run into any problems, they don't build good things, they build the Titanic. Optimism is the idea that we can build things that fail gracefully, that we can build a great whirling machine that when it runs into trouble coasts to a gentle stop from which we can start it again instead of flying apart and showering us all with white-hot shrapnel. And so an optimistic disaster novel is a novel about people who handle disaster gracefully, who don't, you know, revert to barbarism in the moment of extremis and turn on each other, but instead try to figure out in their own imperfect way how to help each other.
Because everything is going to fail at some point, so you need to work out what's going to happen when it does.
Yeah, I mean, you know, entropy isn't just a good idea, it's the second law of thermodynamics. And so, you know, it's foolish to hope that you can build eternal things.
So you're pulling apart all the way through the novel this notion of disaster and the dystopia. You're trying to separate those two.
Yeah. You know, I'm a very proud pulp writer. I like writing stories that center the plot. And when you write pulp fiction, you can get away with a lot of calls on your reader's willing suspension of disbelief. You can ask them in a techno thriller to believe that computers can do impossible things or can't do routine things just in the service of the plot. And when you're writing a disaster novel, you can take the two hoary sides of the pulp disaster plot, man against man and man against nature, and tell the man against nature against man story where, you know, the earthquake knocks your building down, your neighbors come over to eat you. But it doesn't really accord with how people act. I mean, if we saw anything this week, we saw that after a crisis happens, the people's first reaction is to set aside their petty differences and to pitch in and recognize their common experience and try and help each other. And so writing a disaster novel in which the problems don't spring from the fact that just under the surface is this lurking enmity that will spring forward and turn us all into animals, but instead, oh, a desire to help, but maybe an inability to agree on what to do. That actually turns out to be a very pointed and sharp plot because, you know, no one ever stays up all night recriminating with themselves after they win an argument with their enemies. But win an argument with your friends, you might never forgive yourself.
It's almost a kind of book-length rebuke to Hobbes, isn't it?
Yeah, or Rand, you know. both of them are an example of how dangerous it is to only read one book.
So when things go wrong for your characters in this novel, they just walk away. How does that work?
Well, it's about something that economists on both sides of the political spectrum have always taken as a given, but I think that civilians often miss, which is that most things are substitutable. You know, and we kind of understand that. If steak was suddenly very, very expensive, we might find ourselves preferring chicken. If there's a very long line for the tube, we might take the bus. You know, we are more than capable of substituting one thing for another. Even the so-called one true love, you know, as the advice columnist Dan Savage says, there is no one. There's the decimal six. We round up to one, because even that turns out to be fairly substitutable. And it turns out that the walkaways, because they have networks that can help them find things and help them refine them to suit them, they don't care if someone comes along and says, that blighted landscape on which you've built your weird luxury hotel is my blighted landscape, and that's my garbage you've built it out of. They're like, all right, well, you know, we struggled to find enough stuff to do during our working days when we were building this thing. We'll just go build another one down the road on someone else's blighted landscape and see if, you know, if that one works. And it's a very internet-y way of doing things, because after all, if you don't like the way someone's running their free and open source software project, you just take it and copy it and change the code. And that turns out, you know, to not always work, but to work pretty dang well. There's a really good example last year where the Internet Civil Engineering Task Force at the University of Indiana took this core piece of internet infrastructure, the Network Time Protocol, that was maintained by one guy who was kind of, you know, prickly and ran it on a server that he'd lost the keys to 10 years before and hadn't updated. And they took all that source code and they refactored it, made it 30% smaller, added a bunch of security features, and got a whole team of people to run it. And that has become now the new default for how you do network time on the internet, without which there would be no internet. That's a really amazing conflict resolution model. It has the combined characteristics of something very democratic and non-confrontational, as well as some of the drama of, you know, the irreconcilable difference between people that is at the core of everything we care about.
But it's a model that depends very much on abundance. And obviously in the digital world, abundance isn't a problem. There's always, you know, more data there. You can always find stuff. But in the physical world, there are kind of limits to that.
Well, there are and there aren't. You know, I recognized after writing this, when I started touring it, that I've written a kind of inadvertent trilogy about abundance and scarcity. So my first novel, Down and Out of the Magic Kingdom, really concerns itself with what we want, which is, as in the I said in the reading, it's a really big part of whether or not we have scarcity or abundance. So you have the marketing project to convince us to want more material things. You have Marie Kondo, in the words of Koiri Sikra, who's embarked on this project to teach us all that all we really want is a single smooth river rock that reminds us of our mother, right? And what we want turns out to be highly variant. You know, Keynes predicted that by 2015, we would have everything. We'd struggle to fill our days because we could make so much. And he was right about how much we'd make, but not about how much more we'd want when we could make it. And then Makers, my 2009 novel, that's a novel about what we can make. And what we can make turns out to be also extremely contestable. You know, there's a great Bank of Canada study where these two economists who are IKEA nuts had saved all their IKEA catalogs, and they went through and they looked at what the biggest predictor was of a piece of furniture appearing year on year in the catalog. And it's that the furniture gets lighter, right? So new modern buildings, they are orders of magnitude lighter. They have less embodied energy, material, labor than the buildings before them. This building here that we're sat in compared to the old office in Farringdon, this is, for the cubic footage it encloses, probably a tenth of the embodied energy.
It's just less stuff.
Just less stuff. So if it takes six Earths for us all to live like someone from the Fed West, maybe the way we get there is by reducing the material inputs by 5/6. Now, Walkaway is a novel about how we organize what we can make. So we have what we want, what we can make, and how we organize it. And Walkaway is about this idea of substitutability. It kind of extends this idea that Google has, where they have this data center in Belgium, where 2/3 of the time it's cool enough in this valley that they don't need chillers. And the rest of the time they turn it off because the data doesn't care what computer it's running on. You know, in the book, you have this subculture called the Bumblers, who are the survivors of this huge economic bubble in Zeppelin construction, because it's a science fiction novel. It has to have Zeppelins. And, you know, after the bubble bursts, they go into the factories, liberate the half-built Zeppelins, and loft them into the sky. And because the bubble was so extensive, because there are people in every city in the world working on it, it literally doesn't matter where the wind is blowing. There's always someone they want to see when they get there. And so they have this like vastly substitutable future. And substitutability, it's kind of the key to like the Zipcar version of fully automated luxury communism, where instead of each of us owning the 11th best drill that we bought for 20 quid at the local DIY shop, that we keep in a drawer and use three times a year, that at the moment you need a drill, the greatest drill we can imagine, a drill that like refactors itself every time someone uses it based on what it's learned about making holes, and that gracefully decomposes back into the material stream when it reaches the end of its duty cycle, that drill and you just are married by a network at the moment that you need it, and then it, you know, politely tucks itself away into someone else's hand when you're done with it. And yeah, we do like to own a few things for their sentimental value or their aesthetic value, but most of us treat our drills and our cars and our winter boots as liabilities, not as assets, rightly so. And you could imagine an extremely abundant world that was better than the world in which we owned closets full of things that we used once a year, and instead where the things in us just did this dance where they acted like a cloud, like a networked cloud of materiality that we and they married with. And, you know, we have that in a kind of profit-seeking, rent-seeking way. But one of science fiction's great tricks is to cleave a technology from its social and economic context and imagine how else it might be.
As well as abundance, you just need a whole lot of space. I mean, it's. I can imagine that this is a novel set in Canada where space clearly isn't a problem. But as soon as you walk away from anywhere in the UK, you wind up walking over somebody else's lawn.
Well, you say that the UK doesn't have any space. The reality is that the population density of most of the UK is so low as to be negligible. From the perspective of London, it might feel like the UK is very crowded. And from the perspective of an extremely lumpily distributed property ownership, where 40% of the national wealth of the UK is in the Greenbelt, and it's just the underlying land, it's the ground rents, that also may feel like a case. But that is... like an economic dysfunction, right? That's just a grotesque market failure. It doesn't actually tell you how many people live where.
It's just an illusion of the market.
Right. Well, and, you know, there is this kind of paradox of the green left, which is that if you want to preserve habitat, the best thing to do is to crowd people into cities, right? That, you know, all of the kind of the project of the kind of Tory shireism of the green left, where we all would live in a little village like we were in the Beamish open air museum, and one of us would be the dentist and one of us would be the doctor. We'd have small whole farms. That putting everyone in England in that kind of living arrangement would eliminate 100% of all the habitats for everything, and still we would run out. But a super urbanized, dense, vertical version of that, where we have a more equitable spread and fewer empty safe deposit boxes in the sky owned by offshore criminals, that would be something that could conceivably preserve a lot of greenfield sites forever, or turn brownfield sites into greenfield sites.
This is unashamedly a novel of ideas with discussion and debate at the heart of it, but it's also a book full of drones, artificial consciousness, and, as you say, zeppelins.
Right.
How do you make the kind of balance between those two elements?
Well, I think that I've always loved exposition in books, and I don't think exposition is at odds with adventure stories. I mean, it's just a matter of doing it well, and I don't know how to reduce it beyond there. You know, I will happily listen to Joe Rowling explaining to me how magic works, even though magic is not real. You know, technically speaking, reading a book in which someone explains to you how their imaginary magic works is like listening to someone tell you their dreams, right? But if they're good at it, they can do an excellent job of it, you know? And I think that science fiction's exposition kind of gets a bad rap, partly because there was an era in which it was a little less literary, but also because in the early days, the technology it concerned itself with was not technology that most of us would encounter firsthand. You know, the astrophysics and rocketry version of science fiction was interesting on its face. It did tell you something about our natural environment and our place in it, but most people weren't going to go on to build a rocket. But you take a book like Cryptonomicon by Neal Stephenson, that explains how cryptography works and where it came from, what its social context is, what its technological limits and potential are. And all of a sudden, this thing that is part of your daily life, that is just this like literal black box that you cannot peer into, becomes something that is illuminated for you. And all of these policy debates, Theresa May says we're going to build a British answer to Iran's halal internet where there will be no working cryptography that the police can't pierce. You know, all of a sudden, the absurdity of that statement becomes clear because you understand a little bit about the underlying technology. And so I actually feel like telling adventure tales in which the technology has some exposition, but in which the technology relates to your daily life is fascinating. I like reading that stuff, and that's why I write it.
There's also a lot of sex. I mean, is that partly because you see that as part of the world around us or the world that will become, or is it just the shackles coming off after writing so much YA fiction in the last couple of years?
You know, I don't know that YA fiction can't have sex in it, although my YA fiction generally doesn't. There is a... why it can be divided into like the marketing category, which is the promise to teen librarians that they won't get fired if they give this book to a kid, right? But then it's got its thematic elements. There's loads of very explicit sex in YA novels. What a YA novel is really about is about not assuming that the reader has a lot of context, because kids can be first-rate reasoners, but you've never heard of a child prodigy who was a child prodigy as an historian or a sociologist, right? They're always child prodigies in chess or maths, things that are self-contained because you just don't have the years to absorb the context to be a historian.
Brute facts.
Yeah, yeah, just the raw material out of which you reason. And so a YA novel holds your hand as it brings you through some context. In terms of sex, I mean, clearly one of the things that happens when we get networks through which we can, at a very low personal risk, express some of our inner lurking sexual feelings is that people discover that the things that they think of as idiosyncratic and shameful about their own lives are actually pretty widespread. And a lot of phenomena that had always lurked kind of below the surface becomes widespread. Now we have, you know, for example, the recognition of trans identity. And, you know, there's a certain kind of bewildered conservative who says, well, in my day, we didn't have people who thought that they were ladies or men. Everybody knew who they were. And then you go back and you're like, well, what about all those people, you know, the first woman doctor who, in fact, lived as a man? And no one knows, was she trans or was she someone who lived as a man? And is there a practical difference? And, you know, so when you have these people who are reconsidering their social contract, as with many people who have reconsidered their social contract, their social mores change, whether that's the Shakers who reconsidered their social contract and decided as a group to become asexual, which turned out to be kind of a dead end for the movement, you know, all the way down the other end, sort of free love communes and everything in between. And sex is this very powerful force in our lives, and it's a way that of complexifying our human relationships, right? We are both vulnerable and exposed when we begin a sexual relationship with someone else. And given that a novel is really a story about someone who's solving a series of problems or attempting to and failing such that things get worse until they can't get any more worse and you have a climax and the book is over, one of the ways that people really get into trouble with each other is with what happens before, after, and during sex, not with their genitals, but with their words and their emotions. And, you know, hooking into that is a very powerful way to drive a story.
You say that the novel is an attempt in a way to pull apart these notions of dystopia and disaster. But looking around us, we see dystopia novels, dystopia films everywhere. Why is that? Is it just much easier?
Well, definitely you get a much easier time of it if you're plotting and you have easy access to a credible source of bastardry that can form a nemesis for your characters. But, you know, I think science fiction is something of an oracle, but not in the sense that science fiction writers are good predictors. Science fiction writers are no better than anyone else, which is to say we suck at it. But what science fiction writers do is, in our imperfect, flawed, blinkered way, each of us takes our aspirations and fears about technology, and we write our stories. And then the readers, the editors, the people who run literary podcasts, they take some of those stories and they bring them up and they make them prominent in our world. And they tell us what we're worried about, and they tell us what we're hoping for. We are confronted by something called the availability heuristic, which is things that we find easy to imagine are things that we overestimate the probability of. We spend a lot of time worrying about stranger danger and not nearly enough time worrying about, like, inadequate refrigeration. You know, listeria kills a lot more kids than you know, perverts and Macs, but you don't have a national war on bad, you know, hygiene, the poor hand washing. And when we confront potential future disasters as a policy matter, the stories we've told about the easy disaster becoming dystopia in which your neighbors turn out to have been waiting all along to do you in, that actually confounds our ability to cope with disasters. In the same way that crummy stories about computers really mess up our ability to adequately regulate computers. So, you know, when the Tories say, well, we'll just make crypto that works perfectly when it's preventing your heart monitor from getting a bad firmware update that kills you, but fails catastrophically when we need it to fail so that we can spy on criminals, and actual technologists say, well, we don't know how to make that crypto. It either works or it doesn't. They say, just nerd harder. I've seen it work in the movies. You can make it work too. And in the same way, you know, the elite panic that emerges from these easy narratives that are often very racialized and often have this class dimension of the bestiality of people when the shackles of society are taken off, that really interferes with our disaster response. You know, there's this great book by Rebecca Solnit, A Paradise Built in Hell, that was really the thing that inspired me to write this novel. And Solnit writes about how in the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco, just horrible disaster, General Funston marched his troops out of the barracks of the Presidio convinced of two things that he was horribly wrong about. The first was that he knew how to make working fire breaks with controlled demolitions, and the second was that he couldn't let the people back into their neighborhoods to fight the fires he'd set by trying to make working fire breaks. He burned down a quarter of the city, right? In the midst of, he snatched catastrophe from the jaws of disaster by taking a city that was already reeling and burning it down because he was so convinced that people couldn't be trusted, right? And so I think that, like, for whatever reason that story has become so prominent, writing other kinds of cracking adventure yarns in which the solution is people, not the problem being people, that actually is a policy intervention that changes our intuition about what we can expect when the inevitable disaster strikes.
And so writers have a duty to imagine these stories.
Yeah, well, or at least writers who do imagine these stories are doing something socially good. I wouldn't go so far as to say that writers have a duty to take on board whatever it is that I think I should be doing, but definitely I think they do something good when they do it.
Cory Doctorow talking to Richard Lee. Walk Away is published by Tor Books. And Shashi Tharoor's Inglorious Empire, What the British Did to India, is out from Hearst. And that's it from us this week. Thank you to Cory, Shashi, Randeep and Richard. We're out and about at the festival, so if you've got any news or gossip you'd like to pass on to us for us to investigate, do tweet us at Guardian Books or nab us via the Media Centre. For those of you who couldn't be here in person but would like to join in, you can do so by leaving comments on the podcast page. Just go to www.theguardian.com/podcast. But for now, from me, Sian Kane.
And me, Claire Armstead.
And our producer, Susanna Trezillian. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.
Salan Rhiannon, you've been listening here to us recording. How did we do?
Wnaethon nhw'n ardderchog yn siarad gyda'i gilydd, yn rigl. Wnaethon ni fwynhau e. Diolch.
And I think you were extremely accomplished.
So what did you actually say?
I said you did excellently.
Thanks, Rhiannon.
Right, well, I'm know, just presuming you did, because you look as though you probably did.
I had record press, so, you know.
Well, you've got headphones on, you know.
Exactly, I must
be an expert.